From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
She always runs while others walk.
That's Tom Jones singing the theme from the James Bond film Thunderball. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Jones about the story behind this record and his hits It's Not Unusual, What's New Pussycat, and Delilah. And he'll tell us about creating the image and sound that drove many women into a frenzy. Tom Jones has an album of recent recordings and greatest hits. Also, Rock Critic Kentucky reviews Try This, the third album by the singer Pink. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Three large explosions shook the part of central Baghdad known as the Green Zone this evening. A U.S. spokesman said two projectiles hit in the vicinity of the Green Zone, the heavily guarded compound that houses the military and civilian headquarters of the U.S.-led occupation. The spokesman said the attack caused minor damage to a building, but no casualties. Earlier today, a truck bomb went off outside a U.S. Army base in the Iraqi town of Ramadi. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Baghdad.
In a statement, the U.S. Army said one soldier was killed and 14 wounded, and that improved security measures helped minimize injuries. The site of the incident, 60 miles west of Baghdad in Ramadi, is a hotbed of anti-American guerrilla activity, which U.S. officials put down to loyalists of the old regime. In Baghdad, two journalists were injured when a grenade was tossed into the Humvee they rode in while accompanying U.S. troops on patrol Wednesday night. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Baghdad.
The government is sending extra doses of the flu vaccine to hard-hit states. The shots are expected to help people at the highest risk of complications from the flu, but not to end shortages reported in some states. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson announced that the government had found extra doses of the flu shot and bought them from the vaccine maker.
The department has just completed the purchase of 100,000. I want to underscore that. That's 100,000 doses of adult vaccine from Avenis Pasteur. It is being shipped to state health departments now. Is expected to arrive in the states by the end of this week.
He said another 150,000 vaccines for children would be sent in January. Officials said that is the last vaccine available from U.S. companies, but they are also looking into buying vaccine from Europe. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed above the 10,000 level today. Larry Wachtel, a market analyst for Wachovia Securities, cautions that 10,000 is only a psychological mark, but it does confirm that the market has been on the rise for months.
Is it a triggering mechanism, or is it simply a confirmation that we're in decent shape? That bull market has been intact for 9 months. It looks like it's going to go on, and this is simply a way station along that road.
It's the first time in nearly 19 months that the Dow has closed over 10,000. The surge came after reports of strong retail sales and comments from the Federal Reserve indicating that inflation is likely to remain very low for the next year or two. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 86 points to close at 10,008. In active trading, the Nasdaq was up 37 to 1942. This is NPR News. Auditors for the Pentagon have found that a subsidiary of Halliburton Company overcharged the U.S. government and violated other provisions of a nearly $16 billion contract for reconstruction in Iraq. The audit reportedly found that Halliburton's Kellogg, Brown & Root subsidiary overcharged substantially for fuel and other supplies. The company has denied inflating its prices, saying that the higher prices are needed because of the security costs of delivering the fuel in a combat zone. Halliburton was formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney. The Virginia Attorney General's Office has announced the first felony indictments under its new anti-spam law. Jeremy Janes of Raleigh, North Carolina, and Richard Rutowski of nearby Cary, North Carolina, each face four charges of sending bulk, unsolicited email. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
According to the indictment, the pair allegedly sent out hundreds of thousands of unsolicited emails, at least some of which moved through Virginia, where the charges were filed. Spam House, an international watchdog group, says Janes, who it says used the alias Gavin Stubberfield, is number 8 on its list of the world's top spammers. Steve Linford runs Spam House. He says despite the new laws on the books, almost all the internet spam can be traced back to the U.S.
95% of all of the world's spam is currently originating in the States. So it is being carried out by spammers based in the United States.
The two men, one of whom was in custody, are expected to be extradited back to Virginia, where they could face stiff fines and up to 20 years in prison. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 12 points to close at 1,071. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, makers of Silk, organic soy milk available in handcrafted lattes in neighborhood Starbucks. Silk is soy.
Fresh air, I'm Terry Gross. In his early 60s, Tom Jones is still a pop star and a sex symbol. The Welsh singer started his career with a bang in 1965 with the hits It's Not Unusual and What's New Pussycat. The hits kept coming through the early 70s, including Thunderball, Green Green Grass of Home, Delilah, and She's a Lady. Jones made a comeback in 1987 when he collaborated with the group The Art of Noise on a cover of Prince's song Kiss. He made another comeback in 1999 with an album called Reload that went platinum in the UK and Europe, featuring his collaborations with performers like Van Morrison and the Cardigans. That CD was never released in the States, but now a new CD called Reloaded combines several tracks from Reload along with his hits from the 60s and 70s. We invited Tom Jones to talk with us about his career and to listen back to some of his recordings. Let's face it, one of the things you're famous for now is your sexy image, right? That's one of the things you became famous for when you became a star. But I think when you started performing music, it was mostly in pubs to audiences of men.
Well, both. It was, I sang in pubs, which was mixed, you know, but then sometimes on a Saturday night in a working men's club, you would have, some of these clubs were men only, and I would sing to sometimes, you know, just men. So it wasn't always, when I started, I wasn't really aware of the sexual part of it, except for the songs themselves, you know, but I was up there singing. And then, you know, when I sang to mixed audiences and I started singing YMCA to younger people, you know, because of the nature of the songs that I was singing, the sex part came, you know, came along with it. Exactly the same as, not exactly the same, but the same kind of thing that Elvis Presley did. You know, he was singing certain kinds of songs and he was moving along, you know, with the songs. Before that, you know, when people moved, maybe the songs weren't the same. You know, it was because of the rock and roll music that sort of generated that sex appeal, I think.
So what were you singing in the pubs on Saturday nights just to working men?
Well, you know, in Wales they like big voices, so I would be singing ballads, you know, Frankie Lane, you know, type songs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like that. And then some, you know, some Welsh songs as well. There were some songs in Wales that I, you know, that Welsh songs that I would sing. But I was always, you know, more influenced by American music. So it would be pop songs of the day.
Right.
You know.
Let's jump ahead a little bit to when you got your first record contract. And you started recording. Let's talk about your first hit, It's Not Unusual.
Mm.
And this kind of really sets the style for you. Like, you know, lots of brass, a big arrangement. And this is the era when we're talking about the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. This is 1965. In America, it was, you know, like the height of the British invasion. You know, Herman's Hermits, the Rolling Stones, Petula Clark, the Beatles are all on the hits, along with Motown. And you're coming along and doing this, like, really kind of brassy. It's not a guitar band. It's not a band of songwriters. Did you feel like you were going to be, like, sticking out like a sore thumb in a way, doing something really different?
No. What was happening was, when my the guy that was recording me, Peter Sullivan, when he saw me in a club in Wales, he was looking for more rock material.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was singing, you know, the band that I had then were three guitars and drums. You know, lead guitar, rhythm guitar, bass guitar and drums. So I was singing more rock tunes, 50s rock tunes. You know, Jerry Lee Lewis things and Little Richard and mm-hmm. Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, you know, that kind of, Elvis Presley, of course. So that's the kind of stuff that I was doing. Later, I was doing demonstration records for other singers because my manager was also a songwriter. So I would be doing demos for this music publishing company. And one day, I did the song called It's Not Unusual, which my manager wrote for a girl called Sandy Shaw, who was having hits in England at the time. So when I heard it played back, I said, Gordon, you know, this, Gordon Mills, the man's name was, I said, this is, you know, this sounds like a hit to me. He said, yeah, but it's not rock enough for you. You know, it's a pop song. It's a mild song. So Peter Sullivan, my recording manager, said, look, if you're going to do this song, we've got to beef it up. We have to make it hotter than the song really calls for, you know, because it was more like a sort of a Brazil 66 type tune. So Peter said, what about brass? What if we put some brass in it? We need to beef it up because you're singing it, you know, you're singing it aggressively. We need the arrangement to complement that. So then Les Reed, who did the arrangement and co-wrote the song, put the brass on it. And that's, you know, the brass just played along to the Bayon beat that the bass drum of the bass drum was doing. So it made it more of an aggressive record because of my style of singing.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Tom Jones' first big hit, It's Not Unusual, and it's included on his new CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. It's not unusual to have fun with anyone. But when I see you hanging about with anyone, it's not unusual to see me cry. I wanna die. It's not unusual to go out at any time. But when I see you out and about, it's such a crime. If you should ever wanna be loved by anyone, it's not unusual, it happens every day. No matter what you say, you'll find it happens all the time. Love will never do what you want to do. Why can't this crazy love be mine?
That's Tom Jones. It's included on his new CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits, and includes old and new material. Okay, so that was your first big hit. And mm-hmm. How did you go about creating the image to go along with that? When did the bump and grind pelvis stuff start coming in?
Well, that was always there because of singing rock tunes in the 50s in clubs and pubs and you know, dance halls. That just came along with it. You know, I was moving because I just felt like it. It wasn't a plan. You know, I didn't plan it. I was just, and I loved to dance. You know, I used to go to dance halls, and I thought if I could do this on stage, you know, it makes you more relaxed anyway, because if you grab the microphone with both hands, you know, like a lot of kids do when they first start singing, you're nervous when you're up there. So if you can loosen up, it makes it a lot easier. So that movement came because I wanted to feel more relaxed, more natural. On stage. So that's how that all came around.
Of course, to accentuate your movements, you wore very tight pants. Did you get them made to order or did you get them off the rack?
Both. If I could get them, if I could find them, you know, off the rack, then I would. But you see, that again comes from the 50s because the style of clothes that we were wearing were, you know, tight pants and long jackets with very thin ties. It was completely the opposite to what our fathers were wearing. Like my father used to wear short jackets, baggy pants, small shoes, you know, and wide ties. Well, when the 50s kicked in, they called us Teddy Boys, you know.
Right.
Ted is of course, short for Edward. We like Edwardian. It was a sort of Edwardian style dress that we were wearing. So the pants were tight, the shoes were big, you know, big crepe sole shoes. The jackets were long and the ties were thin, and our hair was longer than our fathers, you know, were wearing. So it was completely the opposite to what. So that's where the tight pants came from. Anyway, it came from the 50s. It just, when you're on stage, you see, you're isolated. If you're doing it in a dance hall, if you're dancing with a lot of other kids dressed basically the same way, you don't stand out that much. But if you get on stage, especially singing, you know, with this big voice, then people notice you more. Then the moves are seem to be exaggerated, but they wouldn't be on a dance floor.
Did you ask yourself at the time, like in the mid-60s, how you thought your kind of sex appeal compared to, say, Mick Jagger's or Paul McCartney's or John Lennon's? You know, because you were recording at the same time. I think your audiences were a little different.
No, the audiences weren't that different. It was just I was appealing to a wider range of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in Wales, for instance, on a Friday night, I would sing in a YMCA, you know, to young teenagers, you know, very young teenagers. And then on a Saturday night, I would be singing in a workman's club to adults. When the Rolling Stones first hit, I was singing in a club in London, and they played that same club. Well, normally, I would be singing to people in their 20s and sometimes in their 30s, you know. But when the Stones played there, a lot of these kids came in, you know, very young teenagers. So it's just that I played to a wider variety of people than maybe the Stones or the Beatles. And, you know, the movements, I mean, Mick Jagger was moving because he saw black people move in the States, and he was trying to do something similar, you know. And when he did it, it came out the way, you know, that he moves. And when I did it, it came out the way that I move. It's just a different take on what we were looking at and what we were listening to.
One of the things that apparently always happens at your concerts is that there are some women who throw their panties at you, throw them mm-hmm. onto the stage. Do you remember the very first time that happened?
Yeah, it was in the Copacabana in New York in 1968. It was a supper club, and the singer is on the same the stage. The band is on the stage, but the singer is on the dance floor, which is at and all these tables, you know, tables and chairs all around you with the people. And I was perspiring a lot, so these ladies were handing me table napkins. And then this one woman stood up and took her underwear off and, you know, handed them to me. And it was written up in the newspaper the following day, and that's what started it. And that was in 68, and I went to Vegas the same year. And then the room keys, you know, started, because people that are in Vegas are staying in the hotels, and they have, you know, room keys in their handbags or their purses. So, you know, it was the stage would be showered with underwear and room keys. So that went on for quite a while. But, you know, when it first started, it was very sexy, because I don't think any woman had ever thrown underwear at a singer before. I don't think it ever happened before that, or for that matter, throwing a room key up there, you know. So it was very sexy at the time. But then it became a bit of a joke, because people would bring underwear, you know, in handbags and just throw them up there because they thought it was the thing to do. So it backfired on me a bit.
So when you started to think like it was backfiring, what did you do anything to try to stop it?
Well, I didn't. At the beginning, you know, I would pick them up and play around with them, you know, because you learn that whatever happens on stage, you try to turn it to your advantage and not get thrown by it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd work with it, you know. But after a while, because it became, you know, it was happening so much, I decided not to do it. If they threw them at me, then just let them fall where they will, you know. So that's what's happened now.
My guest is Tom Jones. His new CD is called Tom Jones Reloaded Greatest Hits. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Jones. He has a new CD that combines recent tracks with his hits from the 60s and 70s. It's called Reloaded Greatest Hits. I want to play another record, and this is Delilah. And this is another one of your really, like, big productions, with, you know, like, big arrangement behind you, and you're, like, you're so passionate in this that you have to murder the woman.
Yeah. It was a song that was written by Les Reed, who co-wrote It's Not Unusual. And, you know, he wrote the song and played it to me. And I said, yes, it sounds great. You know, it sounds... But it really is. It's a passionate song because, you know, the man, as you say, actually kills the woman because she was unfaithful to him.
Let's hear the song. This is another one of Tom Jones' hits from the 60s, Delilah.
Flickering shadows of love on her blind. She was my woman. As she deceived me, I watched and went out of my mind.
That's Tom Jones singing Delilah. It's one of his early recordings that's included on his new CD, Tom Jones Reloaded Greatest Hits, which also includes new recordings. I want to tell you a story about that song. Our director, Roberta, told me today that a friend of hers, when this friend was, I think, 13, she went to a big club in New Jersey, the Latin Casino, with her mother. She was wearing a yellow chiffon dress. This was like 1969. And they were going to hear you. And when you sang Delilah, this 13-year-old girl just felt kind of possessed and taken over. And this was very out of character, apparently, but she approached the stage, walked up on it, and presented herself to you. And you apparently were very nice about the whole thing. You sang to her a little bit, gave her a little kiss, and then sent her back to her, back to her seat. Did this kind of thing happen a lot?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, people tried to get on stage. I mean, right up to today, you know, you have to have security there to make sure. But with children, you know, if a child comes to the stage, then you can't ignore that, so... You do the best you can without making anybody embarrassed or anything. You know, you try to do it in the best way that you can. But I love kids. I love to see kids enjoying themselves in an audience. So, but you have to try and keep everything in perspective, you know. So that's what the security is there for.
Is there a part of you during a concert that ever feels or ever felt, okay, enough with the panties and all that stuff. Let's just, like, sit still and listen to my voice. Listen to me sing.
Well, not so much sit still, but the trouble is with the panty throwing, especially if you're doing a ballad, if you're trying to create a moment, you know, in a song, you don't want distractions then. You know, and panty throwing is very distracting.
Yeah,
especially,
right.
You know, especially if you're doing a ballad, you know. It's... It's not too bad with up-tempo stuff, you know, but it takes away from the music. That's the problem with it, you see, because most of the people that are in the audience, I would say 90%, are there to enjoy the music, you know, and to enjoy what I'm doing on stage. Then you have a handful of people that want to try and be part of the show.
Right.
And that's when the underwear throwing starts.
What was it like for you when this whole, like, sex image started happening? It strikes me as the kind of thing, you're in big trouble if you take it too seriously.
Well, even singing as a teenager, you know, when I sang in school, you would get a reaction. You know, that was my ace in the hole as far as the girls were concerned. You know, I mean, most boys are athletes. You know, I mean, the stars of a school, nine times out of ten, they're some kind of athlete. Well, I was, my strong point was my voice. So when I would sing on a Friday afternoon, you know, we used to hold little concerts, you know, in the school. So I would sing and I would be getting a reaction. So I knew that, you know, the girls liked what I was doing. So it was there from an early age. But it just, you know, when you get your first hit record, of course, then it's a big explosion. You know, all of a sudden you're on television and people recognize you in the street, and you know, then it's much more intensified because of the exposure that you're getting.
So what are the dangers of taking it too seriously?
Well, I think you'd burn yourself out, you know, if you tried to live up to your reputation. You know, you couldn't do it. You know, I don't think so anyway, unless you were a Superman.
Right.
But you have to understand why. You know, I mean, I know, or I think I do anyway, that first of all, you know, it's my voice, because I was selling. You know, it's not unusual started to sell worldwide before people saw me perform it live. Mm-hmm. So it must have been the sound that I was making to begin with, and then the visual part of it came later. But you have to realize why. You know, it's like an actor. You know, in a movie, it's the same thing. It's exposure. You know, you have a lot of exposure, and people see you, and you have an effect on them, and you have to understand that, and you know, and get it and try to put it in the right perspective.
Tom Jones, his new CD is called Reloaded Greatest Hits. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, she's all you'd ever want. She's the kind I'd like to flaunt and take to dinner. But she always knows her place. She's got style, she's got grace. She's a winner. She's a lady.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From Starbucks, offering access to NPR holiday programming through the T-Mobile Hotspot service, available at neighborhood Starbucks during this holiday season. And by Nonesuch Records, featuring composer Thomas Newman's soundtrack for the film version of Angels in America, a two-part, six-hour event presentation on HBO. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You don't have to be beautiful to turn me on.
That's the recording that revived Tom Jones' career in the late 80s. Coming up, we talk about What's New Pussycat and more as we continue our conversation. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the third album by the singer Pink.
To turn me out. You just leave it all up to me. I'll show you what it's all about. You don't have to be rich to be mad. Top dirty, baby.
If you wanna impress me, you can't be too flirty, mama. I know how to undress me. Let me be your fantasy, and maybe you could be mine. You just leave it all up to me. We can have a
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Jones. He has a new CD called Reloaded, Greatest Hits, that features recent recordings along with his hits from the 60s and 70s. Okay, time for another song. Now, this is another one of your big hits, What's New Pussycat? And the really funny thing about this song, it's your big novelty hit, but it's written by the brilliant and very sophisticated songwriting team of Burt Bacharach and Hal David. So yeah. This was a theme for a movie of the same name. How did you get to sing the title song?
Well, Burt Bacharach wanted, which he told me, you know, when I met him, he wanted a big voice to sing the song because it was for a Woody Allen film, and it was a crazy movie, and it's a crazy song, really. So he said, I need a big, solid voice to make this legitimate. You know, it needs to be done with conviction, and not, you know, don't sing it lightheartedly. He said, if you do that, it won't work. You got to really, you know, dig into it and make a serious job of it. So that's why he asked me to do it, because he'd heard It's Not Unusual, you know, and like that. And the flip side of It's Not Unusual was a Burt Bacharach song called To Wait for Love, you know, which was a ballad. So I don't know whether he heard It's Not Unusual because he had the song on the flip side or not, but he liked the sound of my voice, and he thought I would be, you know, I would be right for What's New Pussycat. And
how did you like the song?
Well, when he first played it to me, I didn't like it because I couldn't quite... Because it's a very unusual tune, you see. It's so he played it on piano and he sang it to me when he was writing the music for the movie. He was doing it in London, and I couldn't understand it at first. It was alien to me, to the stuff that I'd been listening to. So, and I told him so. You know, I said I can't make head or tail of this bloody thing. So he said, well, look, I'll make a demo of it. So the following day he went into the studio and he. And he made a demonstration record, just him and the piano, you know, doing it. And he said, live with it and listen to it. And then hopefully, you know, it'll hit you. And it did. So, but I still wasn't sure until I actually recorded it. We got into the studio at night. It was a night session. It was from midnight till 4 a.m. And when we came out with it, I knew what he was talking about. You know, I got it then.
Well, let's hear it. This is Tom Jones, What's New Pussycat?
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. Pussycat, pussycat, I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat nose. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. Pussycat, pussycat.
That's Tom Jones, one of the recordings included on his new CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits, which is a mix of old and new material. And now I want to get to one of my personal favorites, which is the theme from the James Bond movie, Thunderball. Mm-hmm. I love all those Bond themes. And this one is so, it's so, what's the word I'm looking for?
Dramatic?
Very, very dramatic. And right. It's very insinuating. God knows mm-hmm. what it's actually about. I don't know if anybody has ever been able to make heads or tails of a lyric.
No. Well, Don Black wrote the lyric, you know, and I think he... I don't think he ever explained it, you know, what it was. It was just, you know, the words came into his head and he wrote them down and that's the way it came out.
I almost laugh when I hear this record because, you know, there's a lot of big arrangements on your records, but in this one, I mean, the brass is really shrieking in the background and there's all these, like, themes from the movie coming up. in the arrangement behind you. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, if all of this was happening in real time, it would be hard to sing. I mean, it would be this like overpowering arrangement. You'd probably have to like stop and laugh almost.
Well, it's John Barry. You know, John Barry did
the great John Barry. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. He wrote the melody, and of course he did the arrangement. So I knew what to expect because of the Bond songs that had been done.
Like Goldfinger.
Previous, exactly. Goldfinger was the same kind of song, and Shirley Bassey did that. And it was a male version of Goldfinger, really, when I did Thunderball. You know, because Shirley Bassey is Welsh, and she has this big, powerful voice, and I think they wanted, you know, a male version of that, you know, for Thunderball. So I was prepared for it. I knew what the arrangement was going to be, and I just had to rip into it.
When I interviewed John Barry and we talked about Thunderball, he said that initially they wanted the song to be Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. But mm-hmm. the distributor of the movie thought, no, it has to be the title theme. The title has to be in the song. The song has to be called Thunderball. Mm-hmm. So then the lyricist had to come up with like a lyric with Thunderball in it. And they all the songwriters seemed to not really know exactly what the song was about. But then they had to convince you to do the song. Well, I guess you were willing to do it. They asked you to do the song. And mm-hmm. Barry said that you said, what's the song about? And he said, I don't know, just go in the studio and sing your heart out like Shirley Bassey did. Is that your memory, too?
Yes. And he said, and at the end, there's a high note, and the arrangement goes on for quite a while. So he said, try and hold the note as long as possible. So I did. And I closed my eyes, and I held the note for so long. When I opened my eyes, the room was spinning. You know, but I did it, you know, because it's, you know, that's the way it is. But you're right, you know, he said, just... You know, don't read into the lyric. Don't try and figure out what it is. Just, you know, just learn it and sing it. And so I said, fine.
Well, good job. Let's hear Thunderball. This is Tom Jones.
His days of asking are all gone. His fight goes on. Strikes like
That's Tom Jones singing Thunderball, one of his hits included on his new CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits, that includes old and new material. Did you go see the movie after it was released?
Oh, definitely. I mean, when Thunderball came out, I was, you know, I was there. And everybody in Wales as well. I mean, they all went to see it, you know. I mean, not only in Wales, but of course... You know, the Welsh people being proud of, because Shirley Bassey, as I said, was Welsh, doing Goldfinger, and then me doing, you know, Thunderball. It was, the Welsh people were very proud, so.
What did it mean to a singer, then, to do a Bond theme?
Well, it was, because the Bond movies were so good, you know, and
this
Sean
is the
Connery,
Sean Connery era.
Sean Connery, of course. So, and very masculine, you know, I mean, Sean Connery was... I think the ultimate James Bond. I mean, he portrayed the role. I mean, that's why they were so popular, you know, so big. So to be associated with that was great, you know, because the movies were so big and so good, and the songs, you know, I think every James Bond song was a strong song. So I was glad that they asked me to do Thunderball.
My guest is Tom Jones. His new CD is called Tom Jones Reloaded Greatest Hits. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Everybody!
My guest is Tom Jones. He has a new CD that combines recent tracks with his hits from the 60s and 70s. It's called Reloaded Greatest Hits. Your career has been going strong for nearly 40 years. Was there ever a point in your career where you worried, it's ending, I'm on the verge of being washed up, it's going to be over really soon?
No, because my voice has always carried me through that. I mean, even when the records, you know, got a bit slim, you know, when I wasn't getting hit records, my live performances made up for it. People were coming to see me. So that's what kept me going. If the audiences had dwindled, if I had gone on stage and I wasn't doing business, then I would think I'm doing something wrong. You know, something is not happening here. But that never happened. You know, the audience. I've toured every year. You know, ever since I started, I've always gone out to the people, and thank God they've come to see me. So that's, you know, that's what's always given me confidence to keep doing it.
What about when you realized that a lot of the women throwing their panties at you were middle-aged? You know, did that make you feel old, too, or older, too, or make you feel like, you know, that it had become such shtick?
Well, it's because of the mixture. You see, it wasn't always that way. You see, the thing is, because of the media saying that, a lot of housewives, you know, come to see Tom Jones.
Right.
And throw their underwear. That was only a handful of people. There were a lot of younger people there as well, you know, and there were a lot of men, not only female. I mean, some of the write-ups that that I was getting, some of the reviews, you would think that the only people in the audience were middle-aged housewives. There were middle-aged housewives there, but there were a lot of young girls there, a lot of young boys there. You know, there were a lot of older fellas there as well. So there's always been a big mixture of people. But I think it was because women had never reacted in that way before. That's what made it different. You know, teenagers, of course, you know, you get teenage idols and you get young girls screaming at the teenage idols. But I don't think women had ever done it before. So that's what they went for. That's what they, the write-ups were always about that. But they should have taken into consideration there was a lot of other people there as well.
Did you ever ask yourself why some of your following was middle-aged women who were doing things that middle-aged women hadn't done to performers before?
I think it's the masculinity, you know, because I was a man. This is what I've been told anyway, you know, that I looked like a man. I didn't look like a boy, and they could relate to me. And men have told me that as well. You know, men have said, look, my girlfriend, you know, she digs you, and I don't mind because I, you know, I love the way you sing as well. And the same thing with husbands. You know, I've been told that if a woman likes somebody that the husband or boyfriend doesn't like, you know, who's a bit effeminate or, you know, not masculine enough, they don't like that. But in my case, you know, they said you're a man's man as well, so there was no problem.
Well, we've been playing a bunch of your early hits. Let's hear something new, or a couple of years old, but pretty new, from your new CD. And this is called Sex Bomb. And it's you and Moose T, who I confess, I don't know. So you can tell me who Moose T is and how this record came to be.
Right. Well, Moose T is a German record producer, songwriter, and The big hit that he had before was Horny, Horny, Horny. It was a big dance record. So then he wrote Sex Bomb with a lyricist called Errol Reynolds. And they sent me the demo on it and asked me what I like to do it. So I thought it was a very commercial-sounding song. So we just changed the lyrics slightly because they wanted me to sing, I'm a sex bomb and I can turn you on. So I said, you know, you're a sex bomb and you can turn me on. So I think
why did you make that switch?
Well, then it's for anybody. It's for everybody. You know, it's for anybody that thinks that they're a sex bomb. You know, I mean, any lady or any girl or any woman that, you know, you're a sex bomb and you can turn me on. But if I'm saying it, it's only me. You know, I'm a sex bomb, I can turn you on. I think it's a bit bragging a little too much. So we just reversed roles there. But there again, you know, kids, a lot of kids that sing it, I don't think they even were aware of that. It's the chorus, you know, sax bomb, sax bomb. I mean, that's what they're getting. I don't think they were too concerned whether it's I'm a sex bomb or you're a sex bomb. We might have overthought it, but that's what happened anyway.
Well, it's very catchy. Here it is. This is Tom Jones, Sex Bomb. That's Tom Jones, one of the recent tracks included on his CD, Reloaded Greatest Hits, a mix of old and new material. You, as we've discussed, have this very swarthy image. When you were young, you were in bed for a year. You had tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
How did a year of...
Well, it was two years.
2 years.
Mm-hmm.
How did 2 years of being sick, and you can tell me how old you were, because I'm not sure.
Yeah, 12.
Right, okay.
I was 12 to 14.
Oh, just you know, as your voice is changing too, huh?
Well, yeah, going through puberty too.
Boy, I mean, that's a lot to go through at one time, particularly
exactly.
For a singer.
Yeah, to be locked up, you know, at that age is, you know, seeing the girls playing in the street and not being able to go out is not only the girls, I mean, all my friends, but, you know, that's when you start to notice girls, really.
Right.
Is at that time, so it was a very frustrating time for me.
Well, how did it affect your life to be sick for a couple of years, years that are turning points in every child's life? Mm.
Well, another thing was they told me that I shouldn't sing, you know, because I shouldn't do anything that I couldn't put any effort into anything. You know, I couldn't do anything physical, no physical activity. So I turned to then drawing. You know, I used to sketch a lot and paint a lot when I was a kid. So that's what... I put my talent, you know, into that. I had to do something to express myself, so I did a lot of sketches. But that was the terrible thing, was not being able to sing. But it was one. It did teach me a lesson, though. You see, something good came out of it, and it's not to take life for granted, because, you know, when you can play in the streets or you can play in the hills, you know, in Wales, most kids just take that for granted. But when it's taken away from you and you're bedridden for 2 years, it's I thought to myself then, when I get out of bed, once I can play again, you know, with the kids, and I can go wherever I want to go, I'll never complain about anything else as long as I live. And that's, you know, that's kept me. I remember being bedridden, and so that helped. It helped in a certain... And another thing, it stopped me going into the coal mines, because in Wales at that time, you see, a lot of people were going into... My father was a coal miner, and maybe I would have become a coal miner, but because I had tuberculosis, you know, on the lung, the doctor said, you know, you cannot work in a coal mine. So that was a blessing in disguise as well.
Did you see singing as an alternative to the mine world yourself?
Well, no, singing to me was a very natural thing to do. I wasn't thinking that it would sort of get me out of Wales or anything. I loved living in Wales. But it was a thing that singing was a thing that I loved to do. And I did think to myself when I was a child, you know, I thought, if I could do this as a profession, this would be fantastic. You know, this is what I want to do. Not to do, you know, have to do a job of work that you don't like, you know, in order to make money, which most people have to do in order to survive. You know, I thought, if I could do this, you know, I have a gift here, and if I could do it as a profession, then that would be, you know, that would be it for me. And thank God it turned out that way.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
That's okay. My pleasure.
Tom Jones, his new CD is called Reloaded Greatest Hits. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Pink's new CD. This is Fresh Air. The singer Pink has just released her third album called Try This. In the past, she's performed a white version of hip-hop, but rock critic Ken Tucker says this latest release expands her range to include hard rock and pop, while also broadening the subject matter of her music.
Just a couple of weeks ago, I chided poor old Britney Spears for announcing she was outrageous by cutting a song called Outrageous. Now I find myself in one of those critical come-up-in situations. I like the new Pink single, Trouble, in which she announces she's, well, you know, trouble, a handful, a rabble-rouser. So, of course, my compulsion is to rationalize this fondness within a critic's framework. Britney was trying to enhance her image as a mousketeer plucking her new G-string. Pink, a professional tomboy if there ever was one, is restating in a fresh, funny way what's as clear as the sneer on her face. Trouble is one of a number of songs she's co-written and had produced by Tim Armstrong from the neo-punk rock band Rancid. Another is called Last to Know. It's as if Kim Armstrong looked at Pink's presentation of herself, the swaggering, baggy pants, tattooed, body-pierced woman who frowns fiercely whenever she's not grinning like a sweet girl, and said, "I know what that's about. She acts tough, but she gets as hurt as anyone does when she's stood up or abandoned." Pink seems to attract collaborators who get her without turning her into their puppet. On her previous album, the 5-million-selling Misunderstood, Pink worked with songwriter-producer Linda Perry, who tapped into the vulnerability of Pink that extends even unto her name. Perry provides Pink with a couple of good power ballads on Try This, but it's Tim Armstrong who's really got Pink's number. Blunt commercial music that permits a tough girl to be both bombastic and hurt, devastated even as she yells angrily.
I gave you 3 years of my life. You always said I'd be your wife. Whatever happened to the days when life was so
Then right after that song, Pink and Armstrong unleash their manifesto. It works because the words come in a rush, forcing the drums and horns to race after her, to be as raw as her voice.
I hide my pain like the rest of them. That's why I'm always laughing. I'm troubled, I'm brilliant and miserable too. That's why I am so funny. I swallow down all my fears with a bottle.
Horn sections, guitars, melodic hooks, rock and roll drum patterns. This music is a break from the hip-hop and pop that brought Pink her initial success. It's not maturity, it's a relentless search for whatever form might best fit the fit she wants to throw. But what I like about her is that for all the trouble she says she is, Pink comes across as a complicated woman trying to find out where she stands, in the marketplace, in her life. That she's willing to compromise to get a hit single now and then, hey, I just think that's a sign of smarts. She recognizes the limits of rebellion and the merits of playing well with others as a life lesson that's as useful for a grown-up as it is for the kids that she appeals to.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Try This by Pink. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeldt. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
She's back on drugs again, even though she knows it ain't right. She can't even call up her friends and say, help me save my life. She's so ashamed of herself that she's gone full circle.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, Audible.com/Fresh Air, and by Windham Hill Records, with solo piano by George Winston, including December, 20th Anniversary Edition, and Night Divides the Day, available at Borders. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Colin Quinn, the host of Comedy Central's Tough Crowd and former anchor of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. Quinn is featured in the documentary Comedian about Jerry Seinfeld, which is now out on video and DVD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.